Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. I am Katerina Stoikova, the host and the creator of the podcast, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. I am happy to introduce today's brilliant guest, poet, editor, educator, Melissa Jorgenrød-Helton. Hi, Melissa, welcome to Accents.
Hi, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You have a brand new book out, your first full length, in fact. Tell the listeners of Accents about this book.
Well, it's called A Middle-Aged Woman Rages, which I didn't intend for it to be the title, but I had a folder on my desktop and I was just writing all these angry poems, and that was what I titled the folder, and then it became the thing. And so there's several sections that deal with the kinds of things that I'm finding difficult to deal with these days. There's a section on aging as a woman, perimenopause. There's a section that deals with the challenges of being a mother. There's a section about separation and divorce from a very long marriage, and there's a section that kind of rants about what it's like just trying to live in America and not lose all hope that the world is good and things that can be better. So those are kind of like the main sections of it.
So, listeners of Accents, never underestimate the power of a folder on your computer where you can open a file and write a few angry poems. And then, when the inspiration strikes, a few more angry poems, and then you have a book.
Well, I think too that the title is about a woman raging, and certainly there's a lot of anger in here, but I think our rage manifests out of grief, out of hope. And so a lot of these poems, even the first poem is talking about what that kind of rage looks like. And it's not, you know, it's not expressed anger, it's not throwing things, but it's, I think the rage manifests in the way where people are finally speaking a difficult truth, or speaking a truth that they're afraid to speak because they're afraid of retribution or people's opinions about things. And so you might look at a book like this and expect it to be full of rants and anger, and there certainly is some of that, but there's also, you know, that anger exists because we have hope and grief that are kind of butting heads, and the anger is kind of born out of that conflict.
What is the price of staying silent?
Oh, well, I don't exactly know yet, because I've been silent my whole life. I grew up kind of being expected to be what other people needed me to be, and to curate my whole sense of self around other people and other things. And so right now at 46, just trying to find what my voice is. There have been a lot of things that have been safe for me to talk about up to this point. But especially as a woman of a certain age, for you to look at the world and say out loud, this is wrong, this is not good for my soul or good for humanity. People don't like to hear that because women were trained to maintain the status quo. We're made to dissolve ourselves for the sake of other people. And I think a lot of women don't find their actual voice until they are well into adulthood because we were never allowed to have them growing up. And hopefully that's, you know, changing for the younger generations. But I think the price of silence is never knowing who you are, because when you're being shushed and then you start shushing yourself because they train us to control ourselves so they don't have to control us anymore. And then you don't even know like what part of you. It's hard to be the shushed and the shusher. And so there's this conflict of what is actually authentic or what you do want to say because you've never allowed yourself or been allowed to actually say them.
I thought my 40s were the hardest decade of my life. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say the same, because I think, you know, in your 20s, you're just figuring out adulthood and what kind of dreams you might have, whether that's education, career, family, where you want to live. And in your 30s, you're building all that, building the empire. And then once it's built or partially built, you look around and you're like, is this what I actually want? I've built this kingdom. Do I want to actually be the ruler of this kingdom? And so there's that classic kind of midlife crisis that we have, but it's more like a midlife reassessment or a midlife redirectioning, a midlife rebirth. And sometimes that definitely feels like a crisis, but I think we use that term to kind of diminish the power of that moment and to mock it.
So what happens when women stop being convenient?
Oh, they don't like that. They don't like that at all. Well, I mean, no, nothing is more dangerous to power structures than a mouthy broad, than a woman who is going to call things out or to fight back. And when women stop being convenient, we're demonized. All the things that a man is praised for, he's a strong leader, but a woman is bossy. He's opinionated, but she's, fill in the blank of all the slurs that we can call women. Men are praised for those same behaviors, and because they don't want women to have that kind of cultural power or personal power, and so they just do all the things they can do to try to force you back into a box. And that's why I love the matriarchs of my world, because they get to that certain age where they're done people pleasing. They're done pausing themselves eternally for the sake of others. And then they're just wild, beautiful, magical beasts because they're not going to take anybody's crap anymore.
Over the years, more and more often, I think about Georgella Lyon's brilliant book, She Let Herself Go.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking I should have that title poem right here in front of me on the wall.
What do you like about that one so much?
One is the inventive language, the many, many places that it took me, and also turning the cliche back on its head that letting yourself go is a wonderful thing
Yeah.
in so many ways. I want to hear now some of your brilliant poems.
I'll start with from the marriage and divorce section. The poems in this collection are kind of all over the place as far as form. Some of them are big, blocky prose poems, and some are have lo really long couplets. There's some in the middle that are kind of set up like a screenplay or a script where it looks like you've got character voices and, stage directions. And there's two in here, which I patterned after Savannah Sipple in her book, WWJD and Other Poems. And it's like a bingo card. And so, there's different ways you can read this if you want to read down all the B's and then the I's and then the N's, but I'm going to read it going across. So this is Divorcée after Savannah Sipple. Selfish, liar, freeloader, new curtains, callous. Letter, blamed, freedom, new address, bad mom. Run, 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 escape artist, free. New hope, unlonely. Tofu, floral tea, divide. New love, brave, bitch, unfolding, poor, so poor, shh. So at the end of each section here, in the book, there's a book spine poem, and that's where each line is the title of a book. And I haven't done any editing to it, and I love this one in particular because all of these titles, all of these lines are Appalachian writers. And editors that I know and love. So this is Maps We Forget to Bring, a book spine poem. Eyes glowing at the edge of the woods, something's rising, perfect black appetite, the girl singer driving with the dead. And I love that one because that's got things by Crystal Wilkinson and Marianne Worthington and Jane Hicks and I particularly want to call them out as some women who fiercely tell the truth in our Appalachian literary community. People try to think that being politically neutral is a possibility. That if there's a conflict, that if I just stay neutral, then I'm not showing favorites, I'm not showing sides. It's a way to keep the peace. But I think that that's a problem in particular that women deal with as well. That when there's a problem or a conflict, we try to just keep everybody calm. Let's just have a good day at the park and not address this issue. But that never helps anything because when we're silent, we are just giving power to the status quo because our silence ensures that nothing is going to change. And so this is one of the poems that's in response to this idea of our responsibility to get involved to some degree in our current American political sphere. Being politically neutral during fascist America. Someone sets another person on fire. You don't intervene because you don't want to offend the people cheering on the flames. This one is a form, I think it's called a high bun. I think I'm saying that right anyway. And it's a form that Marian Worthington was teaching us at the Hyman Settlement School. And it's a prose poem, and then it's followed by a haiku, and that haiku should, be able to stand on its own. And so this is perimenopause high bun. Congratulations. The 30 years of your internal chemistry being in a flux every single day, and how you bled for the sake of the species while sitting in sixth grade math class, and while grocery shopping, and talking to your boss, and burying your dead dog, and all that, will now be rewarded with itchy ear canals, trouble swallowing, heart palpitations, your period being 2 weeks late or early to derail that scheduled romantic weekend. Bloating, night sweats, brain fog, anxiety, depression, muscle aches, inflammation, unexpected full-on hemorrhaging while on a 6-mile hike in the woods with strangers, weight gain, thinning hair, vaginal dryness, hot flashes, migraines, increased weepiness, joint pain, forgetfulness, going from having a good day to wanting to burn the world in the time that it takes to fit a pack of D batteries in the already full family junk drawer. Sudden food sensitivities, new allergies, decreased libido, UTIs, stress incontinence, dry skin, constipation, brittle nails, irritability, breast soreness, dizziness, fatigue, insomnia, tingling extremities, heartburn, trouble finding words, panic attacks, burning mouth, difficulty concentrating, tinnitus, dry eyes, low confidence and self-worth, misogynistic jokes, and more. Womanhood explained. Even the cessation of bleeding will hurt us.
I am in awe of the emotion packed in every one of those poems. What has the reception been so far?
Well, the people that I know and love have given lots of support beginning, during, and after this. I did just 2 days ago get a random friend request from somebody that I don't know. And they sent me a message through Facebook saying, "Thank you so much for this book. It's really great to see the things that I've struggled with or have wanted to say out there in the world. Thank you for your bravery." And she said, "You are a great black swamp woman." Which calls back to one of the poems. And that poem in particular is about being messy, about letting things be gross and full of life that is unproductive to man or capitalism. So that felt really good because I've been nervous. You're always nervous when you publish something because no matter what it is, somebody's gonna like it and somebody's gonna not like it. But in particular, when you look at living in America and people being professionally or socially punished for having ideas about American politics, you heard people who were responding to the murder of Charlie Kirk and then getting fired from their jobs for posting on Facebook about it. So, thinking of those types of things, or when speaking about a difficult marriage and divorce, the fear of of people who you don't want to force people to take sides, and you don't want to make anything more difficult to the people that you love, or the people that you love love. And so I've been very nervous about this, but I've gotten such wonderful support from the people that I know, and now people I don't know are starting to read the book, and it's helped calm my anxiety a lot. And to know that other women, whether through their poetry or their art or through their TikTok videos, them speaking their truth has helped me tremendously learn and find comfort and community. And so I'm happy to be part of that well that people who are going through these types of things can, find comfort in.
What do you say to women who have a lot to rant about, but for one reason or another haven't started yet?
I don't know. It's really scary to be honest with yourself, even if it's just on a journal page that nobody else is going to read, because there is accountability. We have to look at the things we did in whatever the situation, the things we haven't done, but also we have to look at, our forced or trained complicity or obedience. We have to look at the times that we haven't helped other people. And so it can be really scary to be honest with those things. And I would say start just being honest with yourself, even if you're just speaking the words aloud to yourself in the shower or in the car. And then that gets easier after a while. And then when you want to say those words to other people, making sure you have safe people to talk to or to show your writing to or show your art to or whatever it is. Because sometimes it's scary when we start saying things. Aaron Smith is a West Virginia poet, and his books are great. I love his poetry. And I was in one of his writing classes years ago in Tennessee. And he gave us a prompt, and I forget what the prompt was, but we're writing, and as you're writing a poem, you start to see it a couple steps ahead of you unveiling. And so you're kind of figuring it out as you go. And that's the magic part that I love so much. He stopped us in the middle of that draft prompt, and he says, "Okay, hold on, put your pens down." And so then he said, "Everybody's next line is, but what I'm not telling you is." And he threw up this roadblock, and we had to go somewhere else with it. And it was really great. And so I think just asking ourselves, what am I not telling myself? What am I not telling other people? And starting there, telling it to yourself and then to safe and trusted people, and not worrying about what the people whose responses you fear are going to say about it. Because at this point, you're just saying it to yourself, to your notebook, to your best friend. Start there and it gets easier. But I don't think it's ever easy.
How does a poet know that they're ready for publication, both the work and also the psychological readiness?
Well, these are all difficult questions. It's so great. I think a lot of poets think that they're ready for publication before they are. And whether it's that the work isn't done yet, or that they haven't really gotten to the heart of it, they're writing around the truth, but not coming directly at it. Or we can think like, I'm personally ready to have this work out in the world. And then it gets to that point where you're like, oh, well, maybe, oh my God, what is my mom going to think about this? Or what if my boss or pastor reads it? And I don't know that there's a great math equation to say, okay, if this and this and this are true, then you're ready to go, because you can think it's ready, and maybe it is and maybe it isn't. And the book may be out, and then you may say, oh my gosh, this is different than what I would thought it'd be. I'm not ready for the reality of what's happening. So I'm not exactly sure. I think there's a point at which we just move by faith or by encouragement of our community to say, yes, this is ready. I will help you through it. But I don't think there's a clean answer to that.
Tell us about the cover image of that book.
Well, I was debating whether to have an image of a woman, which is something I wanted, and I wanted to have if art to have art from a woman, and I don't I think this is an old dead French man. But I love this. When I came across this, I wanted to show something, because with a title like A Middle-Aged Woman Rages, you could have a woman on fire or a beautiful phoenix goddess, or have some violent kind of energetic image. But when I came across this, first of all, I'm obsessed with circles. I find like my favorite jewelry is just simple circles. I've got just circles tattooed. I find a lot of comfort and symbolism in them, of course, as everybody does. But when I saw this, I immediately loved it because there is such a tension in the moment of this bubble. And there's a like a piece of straw or a stick or what it looks like a piece of broken hay or something, that these two things are coming together, and the bubble is going to pop. Even if nothing pokes it, this bubble is going to pop. They don't last forever. They're these ephemeral little magical things that involve physics I don't understand about surface tension and all that. But in this image, you've just got those couple seconds that bubble is going to exist. And is it going to pop on its own? Is it going to be popped by an external force? Is it because that bubble is floating toward the straw or because the straw is coming at it? And so I just love that nonviolent moment of tension that you see in this image. And then in the bubble itself, you can kind of see like windows reflected and all these beautiful colors. And up in the corner, there's these kind of like, they almost look like sperm, like these odd shapes, and that made me think of an ovum and sperm and pregnancy and childbirth and being born into generational trauma or generational suffering because you're born female or whatever. But there's a lot there, but it really I was kind of surprised that I loved it that much. And I went back and forth about all these other kind of what I would think would be expected covers with a title like this. And I was like, no, all that tension is in that ephemeral little bubble, and it's going to pop, but we don't know how.
I love the cover. Read us one more poem, your favorite one.
Okay, so this is from almost to the end of the book. This is All I Know of the Soul is a Sea Wave, and I was thinking about, somebody had asked me about my thoughts on the afterlife and do I believe in fate and destiny or free will or what. And all I can think of is that as somebody who loves and appreciates science, I know that energy will continue. My body's going to die, my energy's going to go somewhere, my molecules are going to be broken down and used to make something else. But I think one of the problems that hurts us as women and people in general is that we see ourselves as separate from the divine, or separate from the universe, separate from each other, however you want to say that. And so to me, I think of like existence is an entire ocean. And my life, I am one little sea wave that the ocean is wanting to express itself as. And that's going to be a wave for just a blip, and then it's going to crash back down and be shuffled around in the ocean. So I was kind of thinking about that sitting on my porch, in the mountains of Eastern Kentucky, and looking at this mountain and thinking about all these issues of what's my purpose and where do I go and where did I come from? All I know of the soul is a sea wave. I sit adrift on this porch as if on a raft at sea, as if the acorns at my feet were collected shells, as if that brash crow was a brash ring-billed gull, as if the sound of the road trailing the bottom of this hill was wave crashes, as if the November morning chill on my skin was sunburn, as if the overcast faded sky and its impending rain were sun glare making me squint. I sit adrift and asking this ocean swell mountain to grant me wisdom, like billions before me, stepping out into our origin to decipher the future. I think of an old Zen poem, something like, "We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains." And if that isn't all the wisdom we need, like Hallmark, stitched it on a pillow, or AI pasted it in curly font on an image of an orange sunset, it all matters, and none does. because even the mountain eventually will no longer be here. Do what you feel is right during this brief sea wave of your life, because soon enough it will, you will, be drawn back into the salt of the divine and disappear.
What an amazing message this poem is. What an amazing message this book is.
Well, thank you.
You are a first generation college student who earned a PhD. How important was it for you to break the pattern, to set the precedent?
It was very, very important. My father was from England and was done with education when he was 16, I think, and he went into the military. My mother, she's American, and she was valedictorian of her high school in 1960. They wouldn't let her give a valedictorian speech because she was a girl. Now, my mom's 80 something years old now. She's over it. It still burns me up. And she went to college for 2 years, but then dropped out because it was 1962. And if you didn't want to be a nurse or a teacher, there wasn't really anything women could do. And so she got, her MRS degree. She got married and then dropped out and had kids. And she ended up having a good career being a bookkeeper for a farm supply company. And she supported our family. But so I was the first to get a bachelor's degree. And then I went on and got a master's, and then I went on and got a doctorate. And by the time I got that doctorate, I think I didn't do it for my career because I wasn't getting a pay raise or anything like that. I was working at a small community college. But it was really important to me to do that for my mother, because she was kind of thwarted by the conventions of her time. I wanted her to see me go all the way, and also my two young children who are now teenagers, both girls, and for them to see their mother going and doing, education and building a career was important to me, just so that they could see that they do have options, that they can do these things, and that they should have a place, whatever place they want to have in this world, it should be open for them. So it was very important for me to go all the way. Plus, I'd probably still be a student if I could. I just love learning. I'd go back to school today if I could.
What makes a good teacher?
I think, well, my immediate response is somebody who can admit that they don't know everything. Because if you're just a teacher and not a learner, you are locked into, you're limiting yourself. So I think good teachers have to be good learners, and they have to be humble to where they get that information from. Because when people have that position of I am the keeper of knowledge, or I am the keeper of the way, I think that's very dangerous for people who have frail egos, because then they are the font. They are the source of information, and anybody who challenges it, instead of hey, we're all learning together. At this point, I know a little bit more than you, but you can still teach me new ideas. When that threatens their ego, then they are no longer learners. And, people who aren't learners get left behind. Because if you think back just in medicine, in the 1800s, they would cut people and bleed them, and they didn't know about bacteria. If you look at of all the scientists that got excommunicated, and because the keepers of knowledge didn't want to learn new things, I think that'd be my main thing, that you're also still a learner.
And what is the Hyndman Settlement School, and what is your role in it?
The Hyndman Settlement School is currently a nonprofit in Knott County, Kentucky, back in the mountains. We were founded 124 years ago, and we were originally a boarding school. We had a fully functioning farm. The kids lived on campus. We built the county's first hospital, the county's first school, the county's first power plant. And so the town of Hyndman and Hyndman Settlement School kind of grew up together. But once the town had their own school and built roads and could bus students in, we became a nonprofit. We've got four main programs. We do traditional arts like music, dance, weaving, things like that. We do dyslexia and literacy tutoring in several counties throughout Eastern Kentucky. And we're also moving into math tutoring now. We've got the Foodways, which does community agriculture, food education in the schools. And then we have the literary arts, and that's what I do. I'm the director of the literary arts program, and we have things like a publication, which is Untelling. It's a print magazine. We do classes and workshops. We've got the Appalachian Writers Workshop, which is next year will be its 50th anniversary. So that's what I do. Anything to do with writing. It's a great job.
Is it true that you try to read 100 books a year? That's like 2 a week.
Yeah, and I made that goal several years in a row. The highest I got was 120. Now, I will say, you can blast through a poetry collection in a day or two. And also at the time I was driving over an hour to work and an hour back, so I listened to a lot of audiobooks because I would listen, that's 2 hours of reading just in my commute. And that number has dropped substantially, because reading can have a lot of purposes. We go to it for connection, for learning, for entertainment, and we also go to it for escape. And those particular years were at the end of my marriage, and I just wanted to be somewhere else. And so I was just voraciously reading because it shut my mind up and I didn't have to think about things. So I think these days I'm down to about 40 or 50. But yeah, I think my top one was 120. God bless the library.
Describe a typical day in the life of Melissa Helton, if there is such thing, of course.
Well, I no longer have that hour commute. It's now like a 6 minute walk to work, which is much, much better. So usually I'll start the day with a quiet walk through the woods because I live back in the middle of nowhere. And then, my work at Heinemann can range from giving tours to having a workshop to sitting on my computer reading submissions. Most of my work, when we don't have writers directly on campus, is just on the computer. And then, it depends on whether I have the teenagers or not, because if they're not there, maybe I won't cook dinner. But if they're there, I'll definitely try to cook something. But I think a lot of it, sometimes in the morning, I like to paint or draw, kind of like that artist way, doing your morning pages. What's her name? Julia Cameron. Who wrote that book? Anyway, but I think a lot of it depends on my stress levels, because if I'm not falling into a book to avoid stressors, I'll fall into binge watching a TV show like a lot of people do. I've currently, with the stress of this book and my kind of nervousness about it, I've sat and watched a lot of 30 Rock on the TV, or Scrubs, like old dumb sitcoms that I've already watched through a couple times because they're comforting, because I know what's going to happen. But recently I've taken to gathering water from creeks and rivers and lakes and painting with them, doing watercolor paintings. And so that's been something I've kind of been hyper fixated on lately.
It seems to me that you have a special connection to your ancestors, and you literally go to great lengths to nurture this connection.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't know if it's a sense of, looking for myself or looking for the wisdom and the culture that wasn't passed down, because, like I said, my father was from England, and even with him being a direct immigrant, we didn't have a lot of English culture in the house. We had like Monty Python and Pink Floyd, but we didn't wear paper crowns at Christmas. A lot of things that my cousins do, we didn't really have that. And my mother, and this middle name of mine, is Norwegian, and I got fascinated particularly by her Norwegians. And I was so angry that, as I started to learn about Norway and these traditions, that I didn't get to experience any of that. So my grandfather was one of the first kids born in the US. But no traditions were handed down, even to my mother. So my mother went to go see her Norwegian grandmother in Minnesota in the 50s when she was little, and she wasn't given food traditions or holiday traditions or anything to pass on to me. And that makes me sad because they're so beautiful. And it's not just about that country or about that particular food, but it's about particularly the wisdom and knowledge of women being passed down. The food traditions, the holiday traditions, the clothing customs, all those things were usually in the purview of the woman of the house. The man wasn't the one cooking, he wasn't the one decorating for holidays. And those were lost in that push to be American. We didn't want to be Norwegian American or German American. We want to be American. And that makes me sad. And I think of it almost as a feminist issue because all the knowledge that my great grandmother brought to this country, I don't have access to. So I have to learn it from the internet or from traveling up to Minnesota to learn it from strangers because she didn't teach it to my mom.
I have a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing, and that is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing you want them to remember from your class or workshop, what is it?
Make something unexpected happen. Whether that's on the page, whether that's in how you respond to the prompt, or even just the images and the things that you allow yourself to bring forth. For example, it sounds silly, but I wrote with my non-dominant hand for 2 years. Just for no good reason, I wanted to see what my left hand was like, and I wrote with my left hand for 2 years. And that changed my poetry because I wrote longhand on paper, and my left hand was painful and it was slow. And so instead of jumping quickly with the first image or emotion that my right hand would have allowed me to, my left hand was still struggling. And so I'd think of two or three different things, which quite often led me in unexpected directions that I hadn't gone before. And so I would say, let something unexpected happen or make something unexpected happen, either in your heart or on the page.
Amazing.
I do want to say thank you to you so much for this conversation and for believing in this manuscript. And I know, being a platform as an editor and a publisher, being a platform for people to come stand on that stage and say what they need and want to say is a great blessing to the literary community. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for who you are and what you do and what you write. Can't wait to see what you write next.
Thank you.